And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guests are Sean McBride and Jacqueline Michard. First up is Sean McBride, author of Green Grass Grace, published by Touchstone, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Sean McBride was born and raised in Philly, where he still lives. He graduated with an English degree from DeSales University in 1993. Since then, he's worked jobs ranging from maintenance man to mailman to reference book editor. Now he works as a court officer in Philly's Criminal Justice Center. He's the father of a seven-year-old, Chloe, engaged to be married to a social worker at the Church of Elvis in Las Vegas this December. He's a Leo, and he says, "I bat left and throw left." His first novel is Green Grass Grace. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Barbara. Hey, Don.
Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Tell me about, or actually tell our listeners about Green Grass Grace and how the book came about.
That's too long answers I could give. The book is set in 1984 in Philadelphia, and it's narrated by a 13-year-old boy whose father is cheating on his mother, and his brother is drinking himself. He's depressed and drunk over the fact that his girlfriend, his high school sweetheart, had died the year before. So basically, my main character, Henry Tui, he sings and proposes to his girlfriend at a wedding reception, but he does it to try to get his parents to fall back in love and to get his brother to snap out of his depression. So, but it takes place over a weekend in 1984, and it's all about being a little kid, in particular in Philly, in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, I guess.
So what was the genesis for the story?
I found a picture of myself in eighth grade, and I had big feathered hair and a terrible outfit on, and I had a huge smile, and you could tell I thought I looked great. And it was like one of those wagon wheel pictures, and I just thought it was a character, you know. I mean, I just wanted to write about him, and I was getting divorced at the time too, and I was bumming about that. So I was thinking a lot about childhood again. You know, it was one of those real typical deals where I was spending a lot of time wallowing, thinking about, you know, better days and stuff like that. So I was spending a lot of time thinking about childhood, and I just, at the same time, I found this picture. Same time, I was trying to write something, and I just was like, you know, let me see if I can write something, you know, based on my childhood, and that's how it all started. So,
well, a few months back, just before I got in touch with you, I read about you in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and in the story, it said that you'd never had a mentor, you'd never taken a workshop, you never knew a writer, and that you wrote Green Grass Grace on cocktail napkins and borrowed computers.
Yeah.
So talk about that. No workshop, no writers.
Well, you know, I took creative writing classes. I took two of them at the college I went to, and I have an English degree. So, I mean, I think the article just simplified things. I did cover all that with the reporter, but I think they just simplified the angle or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I never took it seriously. I mean, I didn't read a book in college. I was drinking the whole time. And so in that sense, I never did. I was never really serious about it until after I was done with college, you know. I missed most of my classes in college. I just slept off hangovers and stuff. So.
Well, tell about the book. You know, the voice is pretty much your own. You know, this book could be in a pile with other books without your name on it, and it would most definitely be you. And was there anything about that that you had to work on, or did you, when you started writing, were you pretty much just you? You didn't have to sift through all the writers that you'd read, or you know, what you thought you should be writing, or a style in which you thought you should be writing. But did you just start writing like you?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, there was like different stages. The first couple of drafts, I tell people, it almost sounded like the memoirs of, I hope this doesn't sound not politically correct, it almost sounded like a gay British guy's memoirs or something to me. Like, it was real whimsical, and it sounded real forced or something. So that was, like, early drafts. After that, I just decided, when I finally got down into it, it's hard to explain, but I just decided to really let it rip. So, yeah, I didn't really make a conscious decision to sound like me, but I just decided not to try to sound like anybody. Mm-hmm. And not to imitate anybody. And then once I started doing that, I finally sat down and I was like, I'm going to turn on the typer and just see what happens. Just let it rip. Not try to make it sound literary. Not try to make it sound not literary. I think I spent a lot of time, and probably a lot of writers do this, especially when they're starting. You know, you're trying to sound like somebody. You're trying to sound writerly or whatever. So I wasted a lot of time doing that. And then finally, I just was like, you know, I got to just try to let it rip. And that's what I did.
Hmm. So. Well, so how many drafts over how many years?
Probably about 47 drafts. No, it was probably like 5 or 6 drafts over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pain. I don't like the work that's involved with it. You know, it's fun for me to come up with stuff, But it's not fun for me to work on. It almost gets to the point where you feel like you're taking a radio part or something, you know, when you're revising. So I really have a good time coming up with the initial stuff, but then when you got to kind of chisel it later and rewrite, I find that all real tedious. So there's a lot of that involved, you know.
So once you sold it, once you had an editor at Touchstone, how much did the editor fiddle with it?
Not much. She liked where the story was. She didn't like. I really laid the poor grammar on thick, and I really laid the Philly speech on. And so we kind of, a lot of what we did was basically take out double negative. She was real big about. They really cleaned up the grammar and stuff. I didn't have any G's on the end of ing words.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was a double negative. You know, I had got instead of has everywhere, you know. And that's how Philly kids talk, but I think that she felt it was too dialecty or whatever.
Hmm.
So we spent most of our time doing that. And other than that, she really just, we just snipped. She really liked where the story was at. She thought it was pretty much in place. But I spent a lot of time working on it. And I think that all the extra time that I put in before we sent it out was worth it. I mean, I'm a real perfectionist. And, I'm able to read something that I write like it wasn't me, so I can really enjoy something that I wrote that's good. And then if it's not good, it's just I will just cross it out and be like, this stinks, you know. So I did a lot of work beforehand. I think that helped get it to the point where we were just like splitting hairs about little things, little stylistic things.
Mm-hmm. If you've just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Sean McBride, author of Green Grass Grace, published by Touchstone, imprint of Simon & Schuster. Will you read to us?
Sure. And I will set this up for you. I'm going to read. This is basically the second chapter of the book. And like I said, it's narrated by my main character, Henry Toohey, who's 13 in Philadelphia in 1984. He lives on this block called St. Patrick Street. And so this is him basically explaining what his block is like. And he starts that explanation with a flashback about a nun who taught him last year. So here we go. Sister Edwina Immaculata, my 7th grade homeroom nun last year, got sick in May, right in front of class one morning while screaming at Daniel McDaniel, whose hair was a lumpy bedhead mop, for putting erasers up his nose. I thought it was a pretty funny bit myself, but nuns are a different breed. They laugh at corny jokes told by creepy priests and don't recognize rubber erasers up the nose as the kind of comedy that separates the pros from the hacks. I was jealous of Daniel for the bit. Physical comedy ain't a strong suit of mine. I got a laugh or two in my day by walking into this street pole or tripping over that park bench. But it was always an accident. Not Daniel McDaniel. Those erasers were up his nose because he put them there. We all laughed so hard that Sister Edwina Immaculata, who only has one hard breast as a result of breast cancer, Henry uses a lot of curses for everyone out there. I have to take them out and replace them with more polite words here. So, anyhow, Sister Edwina Immaculata, who only has one hard breast as a result of breast cancer, turned around from writing the 7 deadly sins on the blackboard and found one of her students acting not Catholic. Sister, who had a short fuse, flew off the handle and accused Daniel McDaniel of sloth to incorporate the lesson into real life. That is, she broke a pointer over her knee and shouted, sloth, 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 until she turned red and hit the floor. She dropped like somebody shot her. Page is stuck here, excuse me. And she didn't get back up either, unless you can when paramedics lifted her twitching carcass onto a stretcher. Legend has it she sits on a porch rocker at the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart Vacation Home in Cape May, New Jersey, drinks tomato soup through a straw, and mutter slow, slow, slow until somebody bends her over and puts a needle full of horse downers in her spotted butt. All this has nothing to do with anything other than the substitute teacher we got to finish the year for Sister, a young, small-breasted fox named Ms. Jenkins, who was tall with long brown hair and brown eyes. She wore short flowered skirts with sleeveless shirts. She bent over to help you at your desk and you could see her bra. She had a dark freckle on her dancer calf I wanted to eat like a chocolate chip. She made fun of Catholics, designated Fridays as creative days, showed us paintings by great painters, and introduced us to her favorite kind of art, minimalism. Which leads me to my point. If you, like Ms. Jenkins with the flat boobs and ballerina calf muscles, are a fan of minimalism, St. Patrick Street ain't for you. Narrow row homes line either side of the street. The front doors, all white with black eagles, open on concrete porches enclosed by black iron railings. The porches are littered with barbecue grills, big wheels, roller skates, toy boxes, hubcaps, car parts, Phillies and Flyers pennants, headless dolls, dog craps, and trash cans full of empty beer bottles. Every two houses share a cement path with two sets of steps that lead to the sidewalks at the bottom of the steep, skinny, grass hill front yards. The yards are the cappers. Despite the fact that each yard is a foot wide and a mile steep, the neighbors on St. Patrick Street go all out and decorating with Mondale Ferraro for president and vice president signs, flower beds, cardboard farm animals, keep off the grass warnings, American flags, and saint statues. Everybody owns a saint statue. St. Patrick Street has 78 row homes, 78 hills for lawns, and 78 cement statues of dead saints. Wait, 77 Saints and 1 Virgin Mary. My bad. Now add people. The roller skates and big wheels not sitting on porches or under the butts of little kids zooming everywhere. Their moms got short Bride of Frankenstein hairdos, wear fake gold earrings and purple velour sweats, smoke Virginia Slims, and shout at the top of their lungs for the kids to slow down, speed up, zip up, come back, or stay out. Their dads wear Jeff hats, which is what we call those wool hats that the newsies wore, and strut the Paul Donahue's, the corner bar up the block, while their wives warn them not to come home drunk again. Older teens stand in packs of 5 and 6 and hover around cars with the hoods up and their shirts off. Old bags cross their arms, frown at anything anyone under 30 does, and wonder out loud to each other, the Lord, and their husbands in heaven how kids today behave like disrespectful monsters. St. Patrick Street is Irish Catholic, period. Anybody who ain't is a dirtball or heathen or both. Don't live here, don't belong here, and ain't welcome. Even to stroll the sidewalk, unless they like taking beer bottles off the head. So that's a description of the street.
That's great. If you just tune in, you were listening to Sean McBride read from Green Grass Grace. And I must say that that your book and your descriptions of Philly brought it all back for me. My stepfather lived in the Northeast with an L outside the window, and I spent some time there, and this brings it all back.
Yeah, well, I live and breathe the town. I only got out of it for 4 years to go to college, and it was all with Philly kids, just relocated in a Catholic cornfield college. So I spent my whole life there, you know. Part of the blood at this point.
Yeah. I have a feeling somehow that you didn't worry about what people would think when you wrote this book. Is that true?
You can't. I mean, you know, you can't do that.
So never creeped in like, oh, what's my mother going to think?
Nah, I mean, you know, I have a very typical mom. I mean, my mom loves me, but she's a very critical person. So I think I was pretty much resigned to the fact that people were going to whine anyway. I mean, I have a huge family and a lot of real, you know, traditional Irish Catholic aunts and uncles and neighbors, coworkers, and not everybody's happy, you know, with it. But you can't worry about that if you're making something. I mean, and again, like, especially for any first-timers out there, like, you know, it didn't even occur to me to worry about that because I figured it would be a good bridge to cross anyway. You know, you're putting this book together for the first time. And I was figuring, well, if people are whining to me, it means it's published, and that can't be a bad thing, you know? So, can't worry about that. You know, you just got to type what comes out.
Yeah. I should say that the views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guest and not the University of California Regents. I have to say that. Your book was selected for Barnes & Noble's Spring Discover Great Writers program, and I wonder how you felt about that.
Oh, I was thrilled. I mean, you know, I'm not all about money, but it was exciting just on a potential sales level, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it just is an opportunity for more people. You know, you spent 3 years or 2 years writing a book. I'm not one of those, like, you know, elitist snobs who wants, like, 9 people to read. So it was great. It was an opportunity for people to get exposed to it and read it, you know. I mean, I want people to be entertained by my books.
Will you track it? Do you ever look at Amazon and
yeah.
see what it's rated?
Yeah. It's always in like it's always about like 8,000. So
that's pretty good.
No, it did good. I mean, it got as high as, like, you know. First of all, my editor said that they're not necessarily the best barometers.
Right.
But it got as high as, like, it was like number 80 at some point.
Yeah.
You know, it's number 2 in Philly.
Yeah. Well, even 8,000.
Well, actually,
it's
probably
great.
Number 3 now. It was behind Harry Potter, and then, you know, Hillary Clinton's book's out now. So I imagine I'm 3. Yeah, but that's all right. I'll take it. You know, no one's going to knock Harry Potter off that perch. So
right.
It almost felt like being number 1 in the town for a little bit. You know, I was really giving my girlfriend a hard time the other day because she's a huge Harry Potter fan. I actually read one of them, and I think she's a great writer. But she was talking about how she pre-ordered, and I was giving her the whole, like, Etude Brute thing. You know, I was like, oh, that's, you know, she's really giving a hard time about it. But I was kidding.
Well, there's another interesting story you have and that I read about, and that is how you got a literary agent. You wrote what must be the most unusual query letter. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, I did. It was fun. It was really fun. I wish I gave out all my copies as mementos to people who are, like, big, you know, big fans of the book. The way I did it isn't necessarily unique. It was the fact that I wrote it from Henry, my main character, to the agents. And the first, I included that picture that I told you about. Like, that was Dan. I signed it from Henry. And I actually went to, like, a copying store, and I had them, you know, print up, like, you know, 50 letters with this color picture at the bottom where it was signed Henry Toohey. And the first, you know, sentence from Henry to the agent was, like, how you doing, expletive. You know, he called the agent a name. Like, that was the first thing the agent read. So, but, you know, I mean, it was his voice.
Right.
And it was fun because I had gotten rejected with a boring letter before that by about 10 different agents. Like, I put my toe in the water before that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was annoyed because, you know, you get these letters from agents, and they don't hold back. They're going to just tell you blow. You know what I mean? So it was almost this thing where it was almost therapeutic for me. Once I got the idea, I was like, cool, you know, I can call these people a name and hide behind, like, literary license, you know? So it was fun. And I also knew I just would get rid of the people who probably would be offended by the language in it, too. You know, you want to meet, you want to get, like, an agent and an editor who kind of share your aesthetic or whatever. So I knew that I would get rid of the people that I thought had, you know, were a little too maybe bow-tie-ish or whatever. So that's what happened. I got, you know, a really cool, laid-back agent who's into, you know, something that's honest, and he doesn't care that there's curses and stuff in it, and that's the kind of editor I got, and it was all worked out for me.
And is it true that this agent never took anyone over the transom before?
You know, he took out, I think that the article said that the agency had never sold somebody over the transom. I think that was what the article said. Mm. And they had. I mean, I think that I was the first guy that he got, or the first author that he got that, from that way. But, I mean, I don't, how else does it happen? I mean, someone has to tell me. I mean, I've never been an insider, but
well, usually,
isn't that the
way
it happens? I mean, I guess that's the thing. It's cool that people are appreciating the way I did it, but is it just like, does everyone have an uncle in the business and that's how a lot of people get published, or...
You know, I think the hoped for thing is the referral. You know, the agents love referrals.
Yeah, well, that's why there's so many bad books out there.
Mm-hmm. Could be, but there's also some good ones because of it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I guess it works both ways. But.
Yeah. The title, Green Grass Grace. Talk about that.
Oh, in the book, it just relates to, I guess, Henry's dream for like a happier tomorrow. You know, he loves this girl named Grace on his block, and he wants to. He basically equates, like, his family's problems with the fact that they live in this, like, real, you know, claustrophobic cement and brick row home block. And he basically has this dream where he's going to, you know, once he proposes to this girl, Grace, and she says yes, and then, you know, someday he's going to make a lot of money, and he's going to move her and everybody in his family to a farm. So he's real big about green grass and Grace. So at some point during the story, you know, he's just, you know, machine gunning off his dream, and he just, you know, says, like, green grass, Grace. It's like all... Each word's one sentence, but that was the very first thing that I started with this book, because Chloe, my daughter, her middle name is Grace, and Chloe means green grass in Greek, so I wanted to, you know, it started, you really shouldn't start with ideas like this for books, but this is how it started. I wouldn't do it again like this, but I wanted to write her this for Valentine, you know, so I always thought that, I used to call her Green Grass Grace, and I thought that I used to say that would be a good book title, So I literally started with the title, then kind of spun the story out from there. So that, you know, I could have this book written that was about love and, you know, almost like a Valentine to my daughter, you know. Mm. It was an idea I got in the middle of, like, I had a really horrible divorce. It was really just a shootout. And so now I've done that, you know, and she knows that. It's great, so.
That's
but
great.
I wouldn't recommend that to any writers looking out there. I mean, you got to just worry about the title later, you know.
Well, it's a good one, you know. It's pretty, it's unusual. It's sort of a conjunction of words that are unexpected.
Well, I was like that. And in terms of the story, too, I just think it worked because, I mean, on one level, it's just kind of almost pretty sounding, but then it also has, like, a weird punch to it, too, which kind of was, like, matched up with, like, I would say, like, hopefully would be the best interpretation of my writing. And I like ones that kind of have, you're not really sure what they mean, you know, as opposed to, and that's tough because the industry really, like, I got some flack for that from different you know, people because they want such specificity with titles, you know. They want something that basically tells the reader what it's about. Like, if you look at the top 10 books, all of them start with the, you know, so it's like they really want to kind of dumb it down for people sometimes, it feels like. So I always liked literary works where it was kind of like almost vague, the title, and you weren't really sure what it meant until you got into the book, you know.
Sure. What sort of books do you like?
I like all sorts of stuff. I've recently been reading nonfiction, and I'm reading a lot of stuff related to a book I'm writing now. So it's like, in the story, I'm not really interested in plugging it now because I haven't even written it. So, but like, there's homicide detectives, or unhappily married homicide detectives in the story. So I'm reading Homicide by David Simon. That's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
It's that one where he followed, it became the show, but he followed Baltimore homicide detectives around for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading Stiff by Mary Roach, which is another Discover. Great writer's book right now. That book's hilarious. I would recommend it to anyone. I love Richard Russo. I love Lee Fanger. I like Richard Ford. Ursula Hagee I love, you know. A lot of stuff, you know. But I've been veering more towards nonfiction recently, I guess.
So. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm talking with Sean McBride, author of Green Grass Grace, published by Touchstone. Has a wonderful cover as well, and, you know, This is the sort of book you keep at the top of your pile because of its visual qualities as well, you know.
Yeah.
I really like this cover. Did you know it was going to look like this?
No, I didn't. You know, it's funny, too, because they had a proposed one before that. that I really didn't like. I mean, you know, it was nice and all, but it was like basically like, I'm trying to think of a real succinct way to sum it up. It was basically white, first of all, and it was like a shot from behind and below a kid who was getting ready to jump. But it looked like a Gap commercial. The kid was like in a long sleeve tee and in baggy jeans, and I was really giving him a hard time because I was saying, there's nothing of Henry on this cover. It almost looks like something from the 90s, and he looks like he's skateboarding. So I gave them a hard time about that. And I said, look, you know, so they were running all these ideas past me, and nothing was really making sense to me. And I think that I didn't have anything to do with this cover here, but I think something I said triggered something in somebody in the art department. Because I was like, look, you're doing way too much overthinking on this. I said, take somebody with the camera. I said, put a Phillies hat on a Saint statue. Put a beer can in his hand. Just take the photo, and you got the picture. And I said, put like a Catholic high school girl uniform. So I said, just go to any church in the neighborhood. Put like a Catholic schoolgirl dressed on a Saint statue. Put a Phillies hat on his head. Put a beer can in his hand. Just take the picture. There's a cover. So then they came back with this. And then as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, this is it. You know, I loved it. So, and it just was somebody in their art department who just came up with it.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, what's cool, too. One of my favorite books is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes.
It's real, like, obnoxious orange cover.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked it from, like, you know, 100 feet away. It almost looks like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that book was an inspiration to me. That was the only book I think I've ever read where I was just falling out of my chair laughing, you know. And I'm always been a joke teller, so I mean, I try to put other things in the story besides funny. But it was very much a goal with this book and any book I write, where I just want to really make people laugh. Like, so it's almost to the point where they're embarrassed. They embarrass themselves like on commuter trains and stuff, you know. So I like the idea of these people just laughing out loud and everybody looking at them reading my book. So that's fun for me.
Well, you know, this half hour has flown by. Please tell us some words of wisdom to the new writers out there who are not published, who are listening and hope that someday.
Okay, let me think. Write every day. Don't let anybody who rejects you as you're trying to get published, don't let anybody intimidate you. It's a big town. Just don't let them push you around. Keep at it. Don't try to sound like anybody either. Just write like you talk. You know, I think people spend a lot of time trying to sound writerly, trying to make every sentence sound important. I know I did that for years as a young man. So just write like you talk and just let it rip.
Mm. Thanks, Sean. Come back when your next book comes out, will you?
I will do that, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Barbara.
You're quite welcome.
Take care.
All right, we're back again. Let's see if Melinda is here. Are you there, Melinda?
Yep, here I am.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Tell us about your current project, Firefly.
Well, it's an independent film that I wrote. It's a feature film. It's a family drama, really, and it's set on the coast of Maine. I grew up in Maine, and so it's very natural to set something there. It's a terrific place to shoot. It's really, really scenic. And it's sort of a local color in a small town life that hasn't been seen a lot before. It's about a small boy whose best friend drowns in an accident, and it's really from his perspective on loss and moving on.
Where did the idea come from?
Actually, unfortunately, it kind of was based on a couple of real-life instances. My brother's best friend committed suicide when we were in high school, and also there was a girl from my high school who drowned in a similar accident. I mean, it sounds like a very heavy piece, the way I'm describing it. It's actually pretty funny. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That sounds odd to describe it that way, but it's really told with a lot of humor and, I think, subtlety.
Mm-hmm. What comes first in an independent film project? Is it the screenplay? Is it the idea of where it's going to show, or is it who the audience is?
That's a tough one. I think that the unifying force behind any of those things is the determination of somebody to make it, whether it's somebody with an idea or whether it's somebody with a great screenplay or somebody who really wants to direct or, you know, more to the point, somebody who has the money to make it happen. Unfortunately, in the indie world, it's kind of, that's going to be the last barrier to the thing actually happening.
Now, when you were studying film, were you studying it with the view that you wanted to be an independent filmmaker?
Actually, no. I was kind of like, God forbid I should ever make an independent film, you know? it sounded like the worst possible thing that could happen to a person to have this need to tell their vision on screen, and unfortunately here I am, you know? It was more that I wanted to be a writer, and after I'd optioned a few of my screenplays in Los Angeles, or had them optioned by production companies, and seen them get developed or kind of wait for packaging to happen on the end of the production company, I started to think about what I wanted to do for my project myself. And the more I thought about this project, the more I started to talk to people about it and get enthusiasm and people on the team of it for the production and for the filmmaking crew, the more I realized that I also wanted to direct it. I actually was sort of in denial about it for a while because I, you know, it's hard to produce and direct at the same time, and I fortunately found a terrific producer, a woman named Lynn Westifer, to help me with it. But you know, once I started interviewing directors, and they would say, well, I see this scene this way, you know, kind of like, are the boys in the woods, is he kind of trying to reassure him that maybe it's okay, that maybe ghosts come back or something? And I thought, you know, that's a very valid take on the scene, but it's wrong, you know. I realized that I had a really specific vision and that I was the one who had to do it.
In terms of having screenplays optioned, do you have an agent then who does that part of it for you, or is that something you're out there hitting the street and finding companies who will do this?
Neither, actually. The screenplays that I've had optioned have either come through connections that I had at Columbia University, because they have something called the Script Bank, and production companies ask for scripts based on what they read in that catalog, or through people that I've just known who worked in the industry, either who went to college with me or who, you know, I've just met through the course of business.
So you're saying something that I've heard over and over again, and that is connections.
Yeah, it sounds very mystical, though, when you put it that way. It's really not like I'm out doing the cocktail party circuit or anything.
Right.
I just happen to know these people and happen to have shown them writing, and they've, you know, taken a liking to it.
Would you read a few pages from Firefly?
Sure. Thanks for asking. And what I'm going to read, let me explain a little bit more. Keith is the name of the boy who drowned, and Jonathan is the main character, who keeps talking to his friend on this walkie-talkie that the two of them shared, and that he's, you know, still hasn't let go of his friend's spirit, even though he understands that the boy is drowned. Andy, who turns up in the following scene, is a girl from Boston, a city girl who's on vacation on the coast, and she's kind of taking the place of the best friend, but not quite. Caroline, who's also mentioned, just so you know, is his mother. He's a single mother after the divorce, few years preceding the story, and in the course of the story, she also starts to strike up a little romance, which we don't see, but that's who she is.
Okay.
Exterior cemetery day. A sunny cemetery, quiet and well-maintained. The muffled sounds of grief and hushed movements drift through the air. Minister, off-screen. And a time to every purpose under heaven. Jonathan walks by himself, dressed up, through a row of older graves. He looks over his shoulder. Jonathan, into the walkie-talkie. Don't be scared. A terrible, lonely sound of hydraulic gears lowering something into the ground. The sounds of feet and murmuring voices fade away, leaving behind the clean breeze whispering through the grass. Static hisses quietly over Jonathan's walkie-talkie. Jonathan into the walkie-talkie. I'm still here. Footsteps approach behind him. Caroline is there in a black dress, holding Jonathan's jacket. Caroline, are you ready to go home? Jonathan hides the walkie-talkie behind his back. Interior Caroline's room, night. At her modest computer, Caroline goes over a pile of receipts. She keeps an eye on Jonathan through the window. Exterior, Jonathan's house, yard, dock, night. The night sky is empty over the water. Andy and Jonathan are on the dock. Jonathan's still dressed up from the funeral. He turns the walkie-talkie's channels. Andy, can I try to talk to him? A long moment while Jonathan ponders whether to let Andy hold the walkie-talkie or not. Jonathan. I think he's still mad at me. Andy. If it was my walkie-talkie, I'd let you use it. She holds his asthma inhaler up for him, the way that Keith used to. Squirts mist. Jonathan takes breath. Jonathan. Watch this. At the very end of the dock, he drags a hand through the water. Shimmering green light sparkles briefly in the wake of his fingers. Jonathan. My dad taught me how to do this. He said it wakes up the algae. Andy. Maybe it's firefly pee. Jonathan traces a long line of phosphorescence in the water. Jonathan. Did you know that fireflies can light up 8,000 times before they die? I read that on a cereal box. Andy. Do you know that when a firefly lights up, that means it just caught somebody's dream? Jonathan. That's not true. Andy. When you're done with a dream, it floats into the sky and a firefly catches it. That's what makes its belly light up. Jonathan. Oh, yeah? Well, what happens to your dreams in the wintertime? Andy. The air freezes them and they turn into snowflakes. People dream a lot in Maine. That's it.
Thank you. Fireflies, you know, I'm from back east and I miss fireflies.
Yeah, I haven't seen that many out here.
No, I never see them. I never see them here. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and I'm talking with Melinda Hsu about Firefly and about being a filmmaker. When you fundraise for an independent film project, how exactly do you do that? I mean, you know, it sounds so esoteric. You know, I'm going to fundraise, I'm going to raise money. And who do you go to? How do you do this?
I wish I had a really good answer for that. It's kind of like whoever seems like a promising lead, you send them the best presentation you possibly can and a very convincing appeal, basically. I mean, for instance, there's a fellow in Maine who we got the name of through a boy who we want to cast. His mother knows this guy. This is very typical for Maine, you know, at the auditions that we had there a few months ago. I ran into the ex-husband of my former piano teacher's daughter. You know, I mean, this is totally unexpected to me, but everybody in Maine knows each other. So this philanthropist actually has a great interest in children's issues, and he's built a boys and girls club in his town and actually built a big skating rink at the University of Maine. And I mean, anybody from Maine who's listening to this would say, oh, my God, Harold Alphon, that's who she's talking about. You know, they would know. But this woman was really nice in kind of putting me in touch with him, and so we sent him a packet that has a description of the story, some pictures, brief biographies of me and my producer, Lynn, and some other people who were involved in the production, and a really nice letter from me saying, this is the kind of film we want to make. It's very family-oriented. It's about how a good thing can come of a relationship even after that friend is gone. And we will depend on private money to make this film happen.
Mm-hmm.
And also to present it in a business kind of proposal way, because it is a good return on investment if you can get something like a cable distribution, for instance, through Lifetime for Women or something like that. I mean, that's the sort of audience we're targeting anyway, and it makes sense to distribute it there. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get theatrical distribution. I think the big kind of, you know, Hollywood Cinderella tale is somebody like, you know, the Brothers McMullen.
Mm-hmm.
That film coming onto the scene out of nowhere and making a lot of money and being a big hit theatrically. And often, you know, the things you hear back, like the Spitfire Grill was a similar kind of scenario and actually didn't make as much money as you would think it made based on all the press it got. But cable or video distribution is a more realistic and actually a better thing for this kind of film, because what I would really love is for moms and their kids to be able to, and, you know, dads too, diss the dads out there,
mm-hmm.
families basically, to sit down and watch this film and enjoy it and also talk about afterwards what is it like when somebody dies, you know,
mm-hmm.
what's it like to move on from that and not blame yourself.
Mm-hmm. In an email that you sent me in the last week or so, you said that that you heard something from William Morris, that they'd taken a liking, an agent there had taken a liking to
mm-hmm.
Firefly. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it's a great thing. It's not, she's not my agent yet, but this is an agent in the TV division who is repping the project, which is different from repping me, but it's still a really good thing. She likes Firefly and has sent it along to the Disney Channel and Showtime family for a start, because she deals in that sort of audience and that sort of venue. And, you know, in the future she'll hopefully be sending it out to more people, and it's good for me as a writer to develop a relationship with her and then, you know, build on that and say, oh, I've got this other project, which is a similar thing. Or I have this project that's totally different. You know,
mm-hmm.
would you like to take a look at that?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's just, it's so complicated.
I guess it's kind of complicated. It's, there are a lot of moving parts to it, I would say.
Also, an article that was recently featured in Jane Magazine's website.
Oh, yeah.
That you wrote, Suitable Activities,
right.
is just, it's adorable.
Oh, thanks.
Your parents just
totally.
Sound totally adorable.
Oh, they are.
gosh, I wish we could read this. I wonder.
I could probably, if you want to, I can keep chatting and call it up on my computer.
Yeah, why don't you?
Just to give everybody some background on my parents. They're immigrants, and they came from mainland China in 1949 when the communists took over. It's, something that's been both a great help to me and a great neurosis builder. They have been so, you know, the way they are. They're incredibly supportive. I mean, they basically put me through school and that sort of thing, but they just don't understand when I want to go off and do this thing. I mean, they try to be happy for me, actually, is what my dad says. But, for instance, when I told my mother that I was going to make this movie, she said, how are you going to pay all those people? And I said, well, you know, we're going to find money. We're going to find a way. Please don't ask any more questions, Mom. You're going to make me crazy. And she said, okay, I won't ask you any more questions about money. There's a long pause. And then she says, are you going to have actors? Actually, a friend suggested I should have said, no, Mom, just me, a lot of different hats. But okay, I have found the article if you'd like to read from that.
Yeah.
I can read the whole thing. It's quite short.
Yeah.
When I was about to graduate from film school, my mom sent me a pro-con chart. It was neatly hand-printed with ruler-drawn lines separating bullet-pointed itemizations of the income potential, writing opportunities, and social life associated with working full-time and part-time in a production job, a non-production job, or a teaching job, not an option I'd ever been interested in, but I guess you figured you'd take a shot. As it happened, I chose none of the above, but my mother believes in forgiveness. I should add that she's a chemist and very orderly. So is my dad, who's a retired math professor. Both emigrated from China when the communists took over in 1949. They met as grad students in America after tremendous hardships and personal losses. Just to give you an idea of what they went through, i.e. what minimal sympathy they have for my 20-something proto-yuppie angst, before my father left China, he wrote a letter to his parents asking them whether he should go to Taiwan with a nationalist army or not. The mail was interrupted because of the war, and only months later in Taiwan did he get their response, "Don't go." He never saw his parents again. As for my mom, her prize scholarship to study in the States was delayed for a year while she recuperated from tuberculosis. And when she got to Boston, she lived in a converted pantry with another girl, paid something like $5 a month for rent, and saved the rest of her stipend to send home to her family. These people are not impressed when I try to explain why I need voicemail. Regardless, and somewhat amazingly, they're incredibly supportive of me and my career goals, essentially looking the other way as I continue to live a bohemian existence as an unemployed but happy L.A.-based screenwriter. As Chinese parents, they're entitled to take issue with at least four of the words I just described myself with. But I think they've given up on my economic prestige in favor of what perhaps seems a more attainable goal for me, motherhood, or at least marriage. Dating would suffice. I admit that their concerns are not groundless. I'm a little surprised to report that they actively monitor my love life. When I was 17, my dad told me he couldn't understand why I was so interested in boys. But it's become increasingly evident that this is a primary focus for them now. For instance, my dad recently sent me the following email. Dear Melinda, I have heard that you have concentrated in creative writing in the last 2 weeks. You must have accomplished a lot of nice work. However, all work without play would make Jack a dull. In other words, suitable social activities must be maintained during the weekend. With best wishes, love, old daddy. And my mother, who once forbade me from seeing a boy I was dating more than once every 3 weeks, had this response to my news that an old friend was getting married and that I'd been asked to be a bridesmaid. Oh, you're going to be a bridesmaid. That's nice. You know what they say. Then my dad followed up with this email. Dear Melinda, my fourth sister, Yu Qi, and her husband, Chen Wuhe, talked with you by long-distance telephone. They were surprised that you could speak some good Chinese. I mentioned to them that you were born to be talented and earned BA from Harvard University and MFA from Columbia University. You have chosen a special field for which it is very difficult to get a nice job. I am always optimistic that you will succeed sooner or later. They will stay with us until the 19th of October. They have two sons. The elder one, Guang Liang, is married. His wife, Hai Yan Wang, delivered a daughter, who is nearly 3 years old. In other words, my fourth sister and her husband have a granddaughter. Your mother and I have no grandchildren yet. We have to be very patient. One of these days, after you find the right person and your brother will have made his mind, we are looking forward to see our future grandchildren. Good luck for your job hunting. With best wishes, love, old daddy. But see, with embedded within the text, there's warm support for and steady encouragement of my pursuit of art. I can't complain, and I don't mind when my mother tells me that she now prays for me to find a good husband a teeny bit more than she prays for me to find success as a screenwriter, because I understand why my parents are so tolerant of my Americanized eccentricities and my financial instability. My mom gave me the answer in telling me about how she and my dad had run into an old friend of hers after church one Sunday in my hometown of Bangor, Maine. The friend asked, "How's Melinda?" And my father reported with some modest pride that I was in Hollywood writing screenplays. And the friend said, "Oh, that's great. My daughter's in medical school. My son's a lawyer, etc." And the friend walked away, and my father said somberly to my mother, "This is our fault." Poor things. They blame themselves.
That's great. I could see a book of these letters.
Actually, I'm
with
working
your commentary.
It's called 17 Bananas.
Oh, yeah.
You want to know why?
Why?
I have to tell you the banana story to explain to you. I mean, you know, here I am trying to live this kind of carefree, spiritually amused, moved existence, and my mom, and I'm home for a vacation, and my mom sends me to the grocery store, and she says, "Well, we need bread and eggs and milk and 17 bananas and lettuce." And I said, "Hang on, Mom. Why 17? And she said, "Well, you're home Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. That's you, me, Daddy. That's 3 times 3, that's 9. Then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that's me and Daddy. That's 2 times 4 is 8. Plus 9 is 17. She started laughing, and I said, "Well, Mom, what if I want to eat 2 bananas one day or no bananas at all one day?" And she's still laughing, and she says, "No, you can't." So that's how I grew up. You know, it's kind of amazing. That
oh, this is great. It's great.
Yeah.
Did your parents tell you stories? Did you come from a storytelling family?
No, not really. I think it's more that, you know, they're like the ultimate straight people. So I would kind of learn to work around that. My brother and I used to try to get by with stuff, and often would get lost in the translation, so I think that was where part of our humor developed. But, I mean, yes and no. My dad, for instance, when in any kind of situation where he, for instance, has to loan money to one of his children, will also preface this check with, like, a long history of his life, like, in 1922 I was born, you know, onward. And, you know, he's caught me at the kitchen table, and he's started in on stuff, and I thought, okay, now we've got up to the part where Tim and I are born, and we'll have to, you know, he'll, like, know that I know the rest of the story from there. Nope, we go on. And then, you know, in 1974 we got this kind of promotion. It's all about how hard he's worked, which is kind of inspiring, but it's kind of, you know, I feel a little intimidated by it all because he's sort of like, well, you know, it's very difficult to be a parent. We've sacrificed a lot to put you and your brother, and it's kind of like in that vein, you know. Mm-hmm. And my mother, on the other hand, doesn't talk about the past that much, and then all of a sudden she'll suddenly come out with some kind of really heartbreaking story that is something like, you know, I wanted to go see I wanted to go to this party, and I wanted to get new shoes, and my father said, no, we couldn't afford them, and I started crying, and it was really awful, and then my mother gave me a nickel, and I went to the movie.
Oh.
Stuff like that. I mean, you know, you just feel so bad about, you know, in the moment you're talking about how you want a laser printer or something. But I actually found out a lot of stuff for that article, and for the rest of the anecdotes that I'm putting in the book. I did a video project on my parents when I was in film school, and mm-hmm. It was a big hit because, you know, they're very funny on screen, surprisingly. And it was also something that was very revealing to me, you know, stories that they hadn't told me before, or my dad in particular would just open up in front of the camera, or just to watch them interact. I mean, I think everybody, if they get a chance, should just videotape their parents in the kitchen for half an hour or something. It's really hilarious. The kinds of, I mean, you don't even notice it when you're standing there. But when you go back and you watch the video and you see the little, like, kind of shoo away kind of gesture like your mom does it because she's busy, or just, it's remarkable, the body language of two people who've been married for 30 years, you
yeah.
know?
Oh, dear. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Gosh, anything else? God, we're only just beginning, and it's, we're just about over.
Mm.
There's so much yet we could talk about. I'll have to have you on again.
Okay.
So are you going, do you have an agent for your book, and are you...
I'm just looking for agents for both that book and also a science fiction novella that I just wrote in the last couple of months. A friend mm-hmm. of mine thought that I was kidding, and I was like, no, anyway, it doesn't matter. I did write a book in the last couple of months. And other than that, there are other screenplays that I want to polish. There's another science fiction screenplay that I want to kind of adapt back into a novel. I originally wanted to be a novelist and then really got taken with film school and loved it so much that I started writing screenplays. And I enjoyed that for different reasons than I enjoyed novel writing. You know, when I write a novel, you can really talk about what this character's thinking while she touches this other person's lips and this other person's blushing. And, you know, it's just kind of like it's so experiential.
Mm-hmm.
And in a screenplay, everything is an action, an event, you know, a tiny snippet of dialogue and some kind of visual, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Very different kind of stuff, which is great in its own way because you can do something with an event that in a novel would take you a chapter to build up to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on the other hand, you don't get to say, he tried to smile but couldn't right. in a screenplay, you know? So.
Well, you've been wonderful.
Oh, thanks so much.
Any words, any pearls for our listeners who may be writers who are listening?
Wow. I would say that the most important thing that I've found in the past several years of doing this is to stay focused. It's really hard, especially when you've got bills pressing and the whole world, you know, like doing other stuff and wondering why you're not doing the same sort of thing, or, mm-hmm. you know, your parents calling and asking you if you know, you have enough money, or did you change your oil, or, you know, you want to be famous and go home with an Oscar and let all the neighbors know that you succeeded, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to go on in the absence of that. But I think that what has helped me is to try to enjoy the writing for its own sake. And to keep in mind that that's why I came to Los Angeles, and that's why I moved 3,000 miles from home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you, Melinda Hsu.
Well, thank you very much.
And
it's been
a pleasure. Stay in touch and let me know how your projects proceed.
Thanks. Oh, wait, could I tell you one more thing?
Sure.
Could I tell you the website for the film?
Yeah, definitely.
https://members.aol.com/fireflypix, FIREFLYPIX. That's it. And it'll tell you a lot more about the film and production updates, so you can email us if you're interested.
Excellent.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, please email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. That's bdemarcob@aol.com. You can also write to me in care of the station, KUCI, P.O. Box 4362, Irvine, 92616. The show is also internet accessible at kuci.org, as are all shows here at KUCI. Next week, my guest will be New York literary agent Donald Moss. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. Take care, and thank you for listening, as always, and get back to work. Remember, it's all about writing, like there's no tomorrow.